This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dochukwu Onueze, lecturer at the University of Nigeria and a first-year PhD student in the MRC Cognition and Brain Science Unit at the University of Cambridge. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Dochukwu, thanks for joining me. Can you introduce yourself?
Hi, Joe. I'm Dochukwu Onueze, a junior lecturer in the Department of Psychology, University of Nigeria, Nsukka, and a first-year PhD student in MRC Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit at University of Cambridge. And my PhD projects are focused on understanding the long-term consequences that childhood adversity have on mental health and cognition.
Now, early parental deprivation, such as that experienced by children living in institutional homes, has been associated with enduring impairment in cognitive abilities. Yet my understanding is your findings, published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, show that deprived Nigerian children have enhanced working memory ability. That sounds surprising. How do you account for that?
Indeed, we found that the deprived group in our sample consistently performed better than the non-deprived children in working memory outcomes across all analyses. These findings may be surprising to Western researchers who are used to reading deficits associated with prevention in academic journals. And to be honest with you, Joe, the results were initially surprising to us too. However, when you take into account the prevailing classism of socioeconomic mobility in Nigeria, it makes a big sense to see why deprived children would have enhanced working memory ability. In our paper, we had accounted for this enhanced working memory ability of deprived children as a consequence of adaptive characteristics of deprived children towards the prevailing Nigerian social mobility syndrome, where underprivileged children tend to work their way to higher class or what we may call a career success through academic accomplishments. As a person coming from low-income background myself, I still clearly remember the poetic rhymes we were taught in Nigerian primary schools by our teachers that education holds the key to our different successes. Right. So we have argued in our paper that working memory abilities may have been prioritized as a result of the prevention-specific challenges of the deprived children, which include but not limited to chronic uncertainty and poverty. And Western studies have actually shown that working memory capacity, which we measured in our study, is a strong predictor of academic success. And so we thought that this early academic success may be pivotal for Nigerian deprived children. But one fundamental thing is that even if educationalists in Nigeria still advise that deprived children to work harder than their non-deprived counterparts because of the rather specific challenges or adversity they face, one thing that still particularly came as a surprise to me in particular in this study is that even in a laboratory experiment, where some bunch of kids are taken to the laboratory for testing without any prior knowledge or some overnight rehearsal on the type of task at hand, you know, that the deprived children in our sample, we are still able to show superior working memory abilities relative to their non-deprived partners.
Can you explain how important it is to study cultural differences in cognitive adaption during and following periods of adversity?
Absolutely imperative. The editor-in-chief of our Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, Professor Sanoga Baka, could not have captured it any better when he advocated for research on diverse cultural groups to shape perspective and common understanding of child and adolescent development. And, you know, given our findings from Nigeria, which are clearly differed from what we previously know, Professor Sanika Bakar's opinion has clearly been vindicated. In fact, during this COVID lockdown, when boredom and loneliness were getting the better of me, I started writing beautiful emails to many researchers and academics whose works have strongly impacted my thinking and perspectives. One of the academics I reached out to was Professor Bruce Ellis of University of Utah. He sent me another recent paper by Professor Steve Howard and his colleagues, which was published in 2019 in Developmental Science, titled Challenging Social Economic Status, a Cross-Cultural Comparison of Early Executive Function. And in the paper, Professor Howard, they found that South African children significantly performed better than Australian children in all three cognitive functioning tasks, consisting of working memory, inhibition, and cognitive flexibility. But that's not important. What was even of more importance to me in that study was that the most highly disadvantaged South African children from very, very, very low-income families significantly outperformed the most privileged Australian children from high and middle-income families in two out of the three executive function tasks. So Howard studied and it's fine, you know, they gave me so much delight as it showed that the claims we made in our paper wasn't illogical after all. These recent findings from Africa have, you know, clearly shown why it is imperative that we understand developmental cognitive science from different cultural perspectives.
Given these findings, how can mental health professionals translate this understanding of different into their work? So, for example, in terms of how they shaped their interventions?
Yes, in a video abstract of our paper, I initially floated the idea that clinicians and educationalists could promote the cognitive and mental health resilient functioning of children exposed to adversity by exploring ways to maximize their relative strength. Since then, I've received one or two requests from clinicians to clarify or provide additional information. You see, when an individual has just passed through adversity, it is inherent that the foundation of their cognitive and mental health or resilient mental health functioning will be tested to its limits. And if, unfortunately, such individuals live in a hostile environment or surrounded by hostile people who are only interested in highlighting their weaknesses without the mention of their strength or hidden talents they possess, you know, I tell you, it's only a matter of time before they start losing confidence in themselves and start showing deficits in key outcomes. These things are not just only psychological or scientific, you know, they're equally spiritual. And, you know, you don't just see the process, you just suddenly observe that everything is in chaos. And unless these people start pushing back, you know, the success of any intervention, you know, will be limited on certain. But on the other hand, if the strength of these children reared in adverse conditions are highlighted in a consistently sincere approach, and these talents or strength are utilized in ways that maximizes their potentials, you know, most of which are actually initially latent, I tell you, it's only a matter of time before these talents come to light. This idea, I think, holds irrespective of one's ethnicity or nationality. Basically, to your question, however, I think it may be there may be culture-specific intervention approach which we should take into consideration in the light of possible cultural differences in consequences of adversity, as revealed by these recent studies from Africa, they already exist in our Western studies. For example, evidence from Western studies show that people reared in adverse conditions generally have poorer cognitive and mental health outcomes. However, this has always been subject to individual variability, as you still observe some of those raised in an adverse condition who show little or no deficit and, you know, go on to perform well despite their adverse experiences. It may be that intervention studies, you know, become more successful in this Western sample if researchers or clinicians understand the protective factors that buffer or shield this minority subsample against maladaptive or developmental outcomes, and try to translate these protective factors to intervention program in majority sample, you know, who still show a deficit outcome. In African sample, for example, you find that as a group, deprived children are performing extremely well and most times even achieve higher positive outcomes than the non-deprived. That's not to say, you know, that all the deprived children do not show impairments. Of course, just like in Western samples, you know, we acknowledge individual differences in development of adverse cognitive and mental health outcomes, as we still observe a minority subsample performing well below within group and between group performance. I believe that understanding the cognitive and mental health protective factors in this majority are deprived children who show no impairment could help the minority children who show impairments. However, a few weeks back, I was discussing these findings from Africa with three female clinicians, two clinical psychologists here in Britain and a psychiatry in the United States. You know, they were in total admiration of the incredible resilient functioning of these deprived Nigerian children. And, you know, they were unanimous in their judgment that they actually need little or no intervention, as they obviously know what they're doing. And I tell you too, I was very impressed with these beautiful ladies. And, you know, I also think they know what they're doing too. But I believe that what the majority of deprived Nigerian children need is more or less monetary intervention. Just give them big, big money and they will calm down.
You've touched on this, but it would be helpful if you could explain some of your reasoning of why these deprived children would have had this enhanced working memory. Just some explanation as to what you believe is going on that gives them that boost in enhanced working memory.
Like I previously said, due to some inherent stress, you know, which is very specific to the type of environment they live, because these children lived in institutions, all right, in foster homes, and they're faced with chronic uncertainty, poverty, and, you know, due to the Nigerian socioeconomic condition and already prevailing classism of social mobility, which means that people find it harder to move from one social class to the other. This high working memory ability, kind of extra motivation to change their status from, you know, lower to higher. But you may ask, you know, people from non-deprived background as well. This should apply to both people from deprived and also people from non-deprived. That's where you have to really be conversant with prevailing socioeconomic class.
So it's around the issue of motivation that seems to be the driver.
Exactly. And like I told you before, when children, underprivileged children, you know, are specifically told by their parents and their teachers, you know, that this is one of your routes to career success. Because in Nigeria, you know, sometimes you see the people from a wealthy family, they just finish school and whatever they graduate with, but they are even graduating their parents or their big uncles already establishing a company. For them, which they will just easily move into upon graduation. But this is not so for deprived children. For deprived children, it's not just good enough that you have graduated from a university with good grades. Yeah, good grade is good, but you will need exceptionally good grade for people to be moved, you know. For example, consider yourself to be a company owner. You just have kids, you know, who have just graduated a 2-1 degree in a university, and, you know, so many of your other relatives with lower grades. you don't know me and I come into your organization, for example, applying for a job, if I come with the same grade, you will give me a little or no attention, unless probably I have a way superior grade that can become a kind of leveler. So these are the sort of things that happen.
Is there a danger that your findings could be generalized in such a way that some cultural groups could be considered more resilient than others, which in turn could become a barrier to them accessing support?
Absolutely. And no doubt about that. If we are to judge, based on the available scientific evidence, and, if Western children stay only 2 or 3 months in institutional homes, and we later read that they have deficits in all cognitive outcomes as well as brain atrophy. Mm-hmm. But African children, on the other hand, live in the same institutions or foster home for 3-4 years and, then go on to achieve excellent academic and cognitive outcomes. You will agree with me, Joe, that it is inevitable that we consider the potential differential, resilient, and adaptive functioning in these different deprived samples. But more importantly, it is crucial and fair that we also take note of differences in what may be culturally considered as adverse childhood experiences, as well as its prevalence and severity, and how the cultural differences in classification of adverse taken together may influence how people develop adaptive and resilient outcomes. For example, some parental attitudes may be considered corrective and appropriate in Africa, but such parental attitudes in Western countries could even result in state interventions, including a forceful child-parent separation. Right. So these are the holistic factors which we must account when assessing a cultural differential resilient outcomes. And specifically to your question of whether greater resilient function in Nigerian sample, for example, could hamper real-life support or intervention for them. Mm. I don't really think so, and I would like to make this point on a very, very serious note.
Okay.
On the contrary, I think that the greater resilient functioning observed here should even facilitate necessary individual and group support, like subsequent adoption by foster parents or increased educational funding from charitable organizations for these kids living in institutional homes. What happens in Nigeria is that some of these kids in institutional homes are usually adopted, by families at infancy or early childhood.
Mm-hmm.
However, some other children there are less fortunate to find a home at that early stage. And when they grow up to middle to late childhood, their chances of finding a home even further diminishes, because adoption at that later age is seen as more or less higher risk with is the expectation of positive key life outcomes. But our findings on the contrary show that this was not the case. And in fact, children who stayed at the institutions up to late childhood, the average age of the kids in our study was 13 years, mm-hmm. and are likely to even achieve as high academic outcomes as anyone else. And I think our findings should dispel such misgivings about life potentials of kids at institutions, and rather motivate families and parents both in Nigeria and outside Nigeria to go for the adoption if need be, and invest in the education of the kids.
Right.
I feel this is also an opportunity to call for greater academic investment in the kids who eventually will not be able to find a home, but who are very desirous for higher university education.
Mm-hmm.
First, I commend the efforts of the missionary, as well as the charitable individuals and organizations in seeing to the welfare of these kids. But in its current form now, there is always a limit to what they can do to help. For example, the Daughter of Divine Love orphanage home in Enugu, Nigeria, where our institutionalized samples were recruited. Why I commend the DDL missionary for their superhuman caregiving they offer to these children. But, due to limited funds available to them, there is a very small possibility that they can actually sponsor these kids up to university education when these kids come of age, even if they are well qualified and eager to attend the university. So that's why I call on the government of Nigeria, the national and international charities or concerned individuals, you know, to take a closer interest in these kids, especially now that there is scientific evidence, you know, that most of them have what it takes, you know, to fulfill their potentials. And I tell you, when I'm rich enough, my target would be to, you know, to send them all to the university, and if they so desire. You know, but until then, people of goodwill in Nigeria and beyond should step in and offer educational intervention. It's true that for no faults of theirs, they have been battered down by adverse life experiences. But the good news is that they're not lying down.
So the hope is that your study will be used to support the evidence, as supportive evidence as to why that should happen.
Absolutely.
Chukwe, you've mooted the idea that some Western studies that found enhanced performance in deprived groups were not adequately reported because of a lack of confidence. Are you suggesting that the enhanced cognitive abilities we saw in deprived Nigerian children may also be found in other deprived groups, including in children in the UK? And if so, then are your findings not so much a differences between how Nigerian and Western children respond to adversity, but rather to do with differences in attitudes and approaches between different research communities? And if that is the case, how do you bridge this gap?
Indeed, I mooted the idea that it is likely that authors find it harder to publish their studies in good journal outlets when findings show null or contrary results, if they know that they will face unfair scrutiny from peers, or if they have a feeling that such papers will barely be recognized by peers. For example, it's been shown that studies that found significant results are more likely to be cited than studies that do not find significant results. Because papers that reported significant results are more reinforced in the field, you know, it makes sense to speculate that almost every researcher who has up to 5 to 10 years of experience in research and publication may likely have up to one study that they conducted, which was binned halfway because preliminary results showed no statistical difference, or study which was already completed and written, and because of the difficulty getting such paper published for the same reasons, is now filed in the desk. You know, I tell you, file drawer problem has been a major publication bias in psychological research. And most importantly, I believe this happens in every research communities, whether in the West or in Africa. Or the thing is that we are just beginning to learn how early life adversity affects children in Africa, with the adversity exposed children possessing a kind of strong protective factors against adverse effects of adversity. So it is likely that, you know, as findings begin to build around a strong theoretical support, that deprived children in Africa do not show deficits. Researchers who subsequently find contrary or no result to this effect will be very reluctant to publish such results because it may appear to deviate from an already shaping theoretical positioning. Now, translate this to decades of Western studies that appear to revolve around deficit theory, which have shown that deprived Western children show impairments in cognitive outcomes. You know, it is likely that some other Western studies or findings which do not have the support of this established dominant deficit theory, you know, may not have been adequately reported. You know, and it is a very good thing that recently an alternative but complementary theory, you know, based on adaptation and hidden talents are gaining a momentum, and some Western researchers are gradually coming to the understanding that childhood adversity may become adapted, you know, to certain aspects of cognitive functioning, and there may indeed be heterogeneous outcomes following adversity. So when I write my manuscript, or when I review manuscripts written by other authors, I actually encourage them to present a balanced perspective of these two theories of deficit and adaptive models of adversity, acknowledging studies that have both found significant results, non-significant results, as well as contrary results.
So are you saying, though, that if researchers are sort of brave enough to persevere and get published, then it would be likely that we would see some of these results replicated in other groups, in Western children and children from the UK.
Yes, that is my understanding. And, you know, like I told you earlier, that there are also heterogeneous outcomes, you know, that have been reported in Western samples. Mm-hmm. So like most studies have also shown, you know, that some Western children do not show impairments, you know, like when you do a study and they do not show impairment, it is seen as more or less adaptive behavior. So developmental psychologists, you know, leaning towards adaptive or resilient outcome, you know, have interpreted, you know, that no significant result to mean actually a kind of adaptive characteristics in this Western sample. So yes, you are right that, you know, when at the moment, we still have studies that have shown, higher cognitive abilities or no difference between the deprived and not deprived groups in Western sample. But I believe, you know, that, you know, the culture of people not reporting some of their studies that do not show significant results is also obtainable in both Western cultures and African cultures. So it is not a culture-specific thing.
Dutrukwe, what else is in the pipeline that you're working on or further research that excites you that you'd like to mention?
Well, June, I have this nostalgic emotion towards my future research plans, you know. Just before coming for my PhD program, you know, my sweet loving little boyfriend ordered me to get out of academia as soon as possible because he feels I'm a little too controversial to have a successful career here. You know, he advised, you know, probably I should join politics where my right-wing ideologies will best put to good use. You know, Joe, I was initially distraught because, you know, my best friend was very instrumental in bringing me to academia in the first place, you know. Mm-hmm. And I held his hand, you know, as a man would hold his boyfriend and ask him if he wanted to throw away all the love, affection and mentoring we have had, you know, just because we have chosen a different life course. You know, mm-hmm. I was earlier warned by a stranger, you know, that, you know, he's not a great, great guy, you know. But I was blinded by love, you know, which has actually become my Achilles heel. And, you know, if you think that I'm, you know, just being naughty or cheeky here, you know, just hang on to my hand till they show you the video clip, you know, with the swearing and all that. You know, I don't swear myself, but, you know, I would like to be as straight as I can get here. You know, I'm not in any way deterred by this incident. And the good news that my academic colleagues in both Cambridge and, you know, University of Nigeria, you know, are just okay with my right-wing enthusiasm. And I'll be continuing with my sweet science. As a matter of fact, along with my terrific PhD supervisor and two other lovely ladies in our lab, you know, we are just getting, you know, the job done. You know, we are just about submitting a very, very important paper, you know, involving five waves of longitudinal child and adolescent mental health data. So a very important journal. And, you know, when it's published, I tell you, it's going to be lit. You know, at the moment, I can't talk more about this particular paper because the journal rule forbid authors from speaking to the press, you know, about their papers that, you know, that is under review or that has not been published in the journal website. And, you know, yeah, you know, I love rules a lot and, you know, no one keeps them better than me. But, you know, I think it will be very, very interesting to have another round of conversation with you when this paper is eventually published. You know, and as much as it hurts to say that, you know, I now agree with the stranger's opinion about my boyfriend, I still love him and I might even take the positive from his advice in the longer run beyond my PhD years.
Chukwe, finally, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
But before I end, I would like to make a very passionate appeal or call for mutual respect among academics, because I believe that academia holds the foundation of the larger society. And I think that our research and practice will make less positive impact in the society if we do not respect people from people who are different from us and ideas or views different from what we hold. You know, I take myself, for example, in the future, I do love to help the underprivileged or troubled individuals, you know, folks who have gone through adversity of any kind, you know, to live a adjusted life and achieve a higher than expected life outcomes. And I do think and imagine how I can accomplish this if I do not possess the basic moral values of kindness, empathy, and love, you know, which are essential for building trust. And as much, you know, as people in academia emphasize productivity, competitiveness, and, you know, teamwork or collaborations, as the case may be, I think we should also encourage these basic moral values, because absence of these can, you know, undermine our academic community and the contributions we make to the society. After all, a wise scientist once said that science and everyday life cannot and should not be separated. Although my friends tell me how terrible my memory could be sometimes, but if I recall correctly, it was Rosalind Franklin who made this wise quote. And I think I completely agree with her. If you take a closer look, the annoying thing is that most of the things that tear us apart and cause this so much tension in our community are just little distractions, which the real enemy has used to infiltrate our ranks and show our confusion in our midst. You know, rather than discussing things that matter, how we can pay our dues and improve the lives of people in the society, many talking points now are focused on the distractions of differences in race, ethnicity and status, or sexual, political, or even religious orientations. You know, and all these things, in my own opinion, do not matter at all. Okay? So I make this appeal to everyone in the academic community to respect and value one another, because I think that's the only way we all will be respected and valued, you know, to love another, because that's the only way we can expect to be loved in return. And, you know, if we get these basic moral values right among ourselves, the larger society will surely benefit from such positive energy. But I think until then, I think we should not cry more than the bereaved when things go wrong elsewhere, be it with the police, with the justice system, in the government. So my final message to those listening to our conversation is that of love, kindness, and understanding. Personally, I've seen the best of love and I've seen the worst of hate. And I tell you, love always prevails. And no matter how dark the times we live now may be, we must never despair. We must never despair. For even the dimmest of light threatens the thickest of darkness. So let our light shine. Let it illuminate the whole world. Let it bring hope to the hopeless. Let it bring joy to the persecuted. Let it bring love to the unloved. And let us all go about making the world a better place. I say go and conquer the world with your love. Go and conquer the world with the light that we shall bear. Go, champion, go.
It sounds a great place to end.
Thank you, Joe. It's nice having talking with you.
You're welcome. It's been fascinating talking to you. For more details on the Chukwe Nweze, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled ACAMH. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.